What's up, you guys? Welcome to this episode of the All Gas, No Breaks, Living with Physical Disability podcast. It's your boy, Daniel McDade. I'm a 43-year-old software engineer living in the suburbs of Dallas, Texas, and I've lived my entire life with severe physical disability. What do you want to be when you grow up? This is a question that, as a kid, you get asked probably 100 times growing up. Adults like your teachers, your parents, your peers, other relatives, even perfect strangers will throw this question in your face, waiting patiently for your response. Some kids will stammer and stutter over their answers, clearly not having given much thought into the topic at all. Other kids will not have any trouble at all, just rattling off an answer off the top of their head. I'm going to be a doctor, or I'm going to be a fireman. No, wait. I'm going to be an astronaut. No, actually, I'm going to be a policeman and a pro baseball player. My experience as a physically disabled youngster wasn't really any different. I was engaged in this discussion countless times. Much of the time, I could sense some level of apprehension in the voice of the person asking me the question, though. It was like they were only asking me the question because it was the small talk thing to say to kids. There was a definite sadness behind their eyes. Looking back on it, I imagine the real thoughts racing through their heads were something like, poor thing, he's got a rough life ahead, or what will he even be able to do in his life? Exactly how much does a Walmart greeter make, anyways? I get it. Truth be told, I was thinking a lot of the same things. Growing up like I did, you quickly recognize the limitations of your situation. It weighs you down on a constant basis. It's kind of hard to explain, but it's like carrying a whole life's worth of potential on your back everywhere you go. But being physically disabled, you're never entirely confident how much of that potential will actually be realized. This was a major source of insecurity for me, from my youth all the way into young adulthood. What would I become? What kind of career path could I even realistically choose for myself? And once the choice was made, would anyone take me seriously enough, whereby allowing me the opportunity to succeed? I harbored so much unspoken anxiety about this, even to my closest family. Most kids have the luxury of being almost totally immune to this insecurity. Oh, I'm sure some kids worry about these things, but the cloud of doubt about my future hung over me a lot. I've mentioned it before, but I was pretty obsessed with sports growing up as a kid. And, you know, it's not like I needed an adult to break the bad news to me that no, I wasn't destined to become the next quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys when I grew up. I didn't have any kind of epiphany, you know, to understand that playing pro football, or any sport for that matter, wasn't really going to be in the cards. It's common to hear adults throw out platitudes like, you can do anything you put your mind to if you just try hard enough and believe in yourself. This is said to both disabled kids and able-bodied kids alike, sure, but are you filling their heads with this myopic nonsense for your benefit or theirs? Don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that adults take on the role of dream crusher when it comes to physically disabled kids like me. But there has to be a balance. My parents never tried to limit me in any type of way, but they also wanted me to approach life in a practical way. When I got to high school, I found myself wanting to make some money. You know, this is pretty typical of kids this age. You want to achieve some level of independence from your parents. Have some spending money, go to the mall, go to the movies, hang out with your friends, whatnot. But, as we all know, employment options are a little limited for kids of this age. And as a severely physically disabled youngster, you know, my options were pretty much nothing. What exactly was I going to do at a fast food joint, or any restaurant, for that matter? Retail jobs, same deal. I just couldn't physically do any of the tasks required to keep any of those jobs. Maybe they could post me up in the corner at some type of attraction to the customers. But that was about it. My anxiety level at this point hit DEFCON 3. You know, you guys have to understand, I was already coming to grips with the stark reality that my entire life might be a huge burden to friends and family. How could I support myself if there wasn't anything in the world that I could do to, you know, actually support myself? I certainly wasn't going to play professional sports, but that didn't mean that I couldn't write about sports or talk about it when I grew up, right? In fact, this was the plan when I went off to college. I majored in journalism for the first few years, set to take the world by storm with my insightful commentary and hot takes. A few years into college, though, I figured out a few things. First, journalists really have a passion for their jobs. They better, because 98% of them receive payment in the form of actual peanuts. Like, their editors come out into the newsroom and just throw open a jar of mixed nuts, while the writers scatter about for their share of the spoils. Only a select few sports writers make it big. I loved sports, but I realized I didn't love it enough to eke out a meager existence, tolling away in print media in a dying industry. No, your boy likes living comfortably. We grew up poor during long stretches of my childhood. My life, as a physically disabled person, is hard enough as it is, without worrying about whether or not I'd be engaged in a mad scramble at the end of every month, searching the couch cushions for that month's rent. The second thing that I realized during this point in my life was that the whole world was changing. Bigly. Technology was dramatically changing the way in which the world operated for everyone. More to the point, everything in the technology space could be done via computers. Now, this was a path forward, where my physical limitations could be overcome. It also didn't hurt that companies were paying big starting salaries, relatively speaking, for young grads entering various technology fields. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. If you've listened to my show before, you already knew that my life took this career path. I've ended up making a solid career for myself in software development. But that's not really the point, now is it? The point is that kids growing up like I did need to understand that finding a career path is not always going to be obvious. It will be a challenge, just like everything else in their lives. You also need some good fortune. I was extremely fortunate that I was born when I was. The tech boom aligned perfectly with my transition into adulthood. If I had been born even 5 years earlier, I might have ended up writing at some local rag, dreaming of the day when I could afford an occasional night out at Olive Garden. As it is, you know, I could probably go to Olive Garden every night of the week. True baller, I know. When I was at the tail end of my collegiate experience, I felt confident in my career path. Probably for the first time in my life, I began to feel that cloud of doubt start to break up around me. Maybe I'd be okay after all. Maybe I too could get that corner office one day. Here was the thing, though. I wasn't the only one who decided to choose this path. The tech job career was one of, if not the fastest growing, career choices at this time. Competition was fierce for upcoming graduates. These firms had limited spots and quite a few candidates to choose from. Self-doubt started seeping in again. Why would any of these great companies choose me over one of the other able-bodied candidates? In a job interview setting, as you guys probably know, a first impression is almost as important as one's resume. And let's face it, a stranger's first impression of me could be all over the map. Sympathy, pity, pure astonishment that I could speak on my own, admiration. I might have a perfect resume on paper compared to the other candidates, but if the recruiter on the other side of the desk was simply too intimidated by my unique situation, my qualifications weren't going to mean jack. I went to countless interviews during that last year of college, always knowing it might be a coin flip if the company rep wanted to give me a fair shake or not. In the end, I landed a good gig with one of the biggest companies in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. I had somehow convinced a legit company that investing time and energy into me wasn't some huge gamble just because I had a severe physical disability. I do admit, though, that the thought crossed my brain that my hiring was part of achieving a diversity quota. Many people don't understand that this isn't something companies engage in only on the basis of race. This is something some also do on the basis of disability. But in any case, simply landing a job, any job, certainly one as good as this, felt like a major accomplishment to me. I saw a statistic that said one out of every 10 working age individuals in the United States claimed to have a substantial disability affecting their ability to work. That equates to about 20 million people in the country. This could be in the form of a physical disability like mine, or a cognitive disability, such as someone on the autism spectrum. I actually find this number pretty funny because I've worked for over 20 years across multiple industries: energy, telecom, nonprofit, healthcare, and one of the biggest metropolitan areas in the entire U.S. And I've probably run across no more than 5 people who were clearly disabled. I realize that not all disabilities are obvious and clearly present like mine is. So I'm sure a fairly large percentage of this figure falls into that category. But still, while 20 million people may seem like a really high number, you aren't that likely to come across a lot of disabled people on your job. That's not to say that my professional life hasn't had its share of bumps along the road. I still deal with the occasional idiot who doesn't know how to reconcile their preconceived notions about my disability with the quality of my work that they see. I've had people actually come up to me and say, "Man, you aren't anything like I thought you'd be. You're really good at this." Wow, thanks. I think they thought I would just sit there and drool all over my keyboard uncontrollably while a magic tech fairy did all the work for me. To be fair, most people don't even realize how poorly their comments come across. They're just pre-wired to think how someone that looks like me should perform on the job. Any job. In most cases, they probably feel that the physically disabled should be able to do any job at all. This stereotype has been deeply rooted since the dawn of existence. Hell, we have touched on this before on this very show. I call it a polite insult disguised in the form of low expectations. It wasn't until the Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law back in 1990 that any wide-sweeping legislation existed to protect the civil rights of the disabled. Other laws had been passed up till this point, sure. The Rehab Act of 1973 is a good example, but these guidelines were very piecemeal in nature. Nothing was comprehensive to the extent of the ADA. The ADA basically tries to level the playing field on a lot of things: housing, transportation, and yes, employment. We could debate about the effectiveness of the law in practice, but that's a discussion for a different day. I've really only had to ask for a few reasonable accommodations under the guidelines of the ADA a few times in my professional career. I need a smaller keyboard than the standard size. I also need the height of my desk to be adjusted to easily pull up to it in my wheelchair. That's pretty much it. I'm sure others might ask for more in my situation, but I attempt to limit my requests to the absolute bare minimum. I'm already battling the weight of those low expectations every time I go to somewhere new, so I prefer not to make any waves. While the signing of the ADA into law was a landmark day in the fight for disability rights, there's actually a pretty long history of the disabled fighting for the right to work on the same playing field as everyone else. One of the most well-known fights happened in 1935 in New York City. This happened during the middle of the Great Depression. President Roosevelt had tried to kickstart the country through all of his New Deal platform initiatives. One of the employment initiatives at the heart of his New Deal platform was the creation of millions of federal jobs. Most of these jobs were in public works, construction, sanitation, etc. The effort was administered through a program called the Works Progress Administration. This sounds like a great thing, until you realize that the initiative explicitly discriminated against the disabled, specifically excluding them from employment under the program regulations. This wasn't really all that uncommon during this time in our history. The Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 established the minimum wage, which obviously is great. That's a good thing. But the disabled were completely exempt from the law. This was what allowed employers to put the disabled in sheltered workshops and pay them almost nothing without breaking any laws. Well, after their application for jobs through the WPA were denied, a small group of physically disabled individuals decided that this discrimination wasn't going to stand. Again, hold the handicap jokes. These folks decided to go down to the bureau office to demand a sit-down with the local administrator. This administrator was a man named Oswald Noth. When Noth initially refused to parley, these people staged a sit-in right there in the bureau office. This protest would draw the attention of the press, of course, and they began covering the story. At the height of the protest, there were hundreds of folks participating, disabled and non-disabled alike. Noth, he just claimed that he was following the guidelines set forth in the federal law that governed the program. He was right, legally speaking, of course, but these folks weren't hearing any of it. Eventually, the police had to be called in, and about a dozen protesters were arrested and taken away to jail. Protests continued on, albeit on a smaller scale. Those arrested would eventually be convicted of disorderly conduct. But in a ruling that belied the judge's own prejudice, only the able-bodied individuals would be forced to serve jail time. The disabled were simply released and immediately rejoined the picket lines. The group at the heart of this movement didn't actually have a name at first, but they would finally name themselves the League of the Physically Handicapped. Pretty cool, actually. It sounds like the name of a dark humor superhero movie I'd like to be a part of. In the end, the LPH had only middling success, though, at least in terms of effecting real change. The WPA would eventually concede to the point of granting a handful of jobs to the physically disabled, but they did so without even modifying the program regulations under the WPA. The real impact of the LPH was the manner in which they began to change the way in which the physically handicapped were viewed. They showed that the disabled were not merely helpless invalids who were unwilling or unable to fight the good fight for their rights. These events really laid the groundwork for the adoption of the social model of disability during the civil rights movement that would happen during the 1960s and 70s, as opposed to the prevailing medical model of disability, which had been in place up until that point in history. There is a real sad irony in the LPH's entire struggle against the explicit discrimination of the WPA. You see, the WPA was considered a huge win for President Roosevelt's New Deal platform. At its peak, almost 4 million people were working jobs due to this initiative. But the president's own application would have been rejected under the guidelines set forth. You see, FDR, as most should know, was himself paralyzed from the waist down. His childhood polio had left FDR unable to walk. The man spent his entire life hiding the fact that he was himself disabled. This is another prime example of the notion of physical disability being viewed through a prism of weakness by the rest of the world. The last thing anyone wanted was for the President of the United States to be seen as physically weak, because they would have to assume he was mentally weak as well, right? Right. I am extremely blessed. Despite my physical limitations, I have actually carved out a real career for myself in the professional world. But my story is the exception, not the rule. The disabled still rank near the tops in terms of poverty rates and unemployment. A lot has to go right for someone with a severe physical disability to achieve the same level of success as I have. An individual needs a lot of internal motivation and self-determination. You have to have a you-against-the-world mentality, because while a society may not be hell-bent on your failure, it's still not set up to aid in your success either. Well, we've come to the end of this episode of the All Gas No Breaks Living with Physical Disability podcast. If you like the podcast and want to hear more, please subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app. Also, please reach out to us on all social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you get a chance, please rate and review the podcast as it helps us grow. Until next time, this is Daniel McDade signing off. Keep the hammer down and never stop moving forward. Thanks for listening and have a great day.